Because it's Monday, we have this great feature that I love. It is the feature that we do with Boston Globe columnists, and we get to talk about the issues of the day. Sometimes we talk about their very, very specific column, and then sometimes we talk about things that we just want to bounce around with. And Jeff Jacoby is our Boston Globe columnist today. He had a great column in yesterday's Sunday Globe about the other David Mamet. He says David Mamet came out of the closet this month. No, 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 not that closet. What I call the idea closet. Jeff Jacoby always writing about ideas, principles, philosophy of government. Always makes it fun. And to see that David Mamet is showing some growth, hey, that's reassuring to us all. We welcome back to Finneran's Forum the one and only Jeff Jacoby. How are you this morning, Jeff?
I'm doing just fine, but I'm feeling, you know, pain in my gut at the thought of what the ghost of Dr. Seuss must be going through right now. Spinning in his grave.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they just did multiple injustices and injuries to Dr.
Could you, would you with a goat?
Oh,
could you, would you on a boat? Hey, yeah. Interesting show this morning. I've been catching bits and pieces of it on and off. I would never have guessed that you get so many calls on the subject of trash.
Can you? And, oh, yeah, bottle bill. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'll tell you something. One of the big gripes in my neighborhood, I live in Brookline, and one of my biggest gripes all along has been the carelessness with which people will put out their trash. You know, they'll put out the bags and boxes filled with loose stuff. They don't put a lid on it. They don't put a cover on it. It gets very windy. We live at the bottom of the hill, so, of course, you know, it blows all over the place and ends up in the Jacoby's backyard.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the trash collectors come along, and, you know, they are not exactly the most
fastidious.
You know, fastidious, exactly.
Yeah, fastidious and trash collection, just usually not
together.
In the same
but
sentence.
So every now and then, you know, I take my boys, we just go around the neighborhood on a Sunday morning just picking stuff up.
A little cleanup.
To make the place look a little better.
A little cleanup. And I don't know what it is about my little street in Mattapan, but whenever there are high winds, I don't know what it was, but you know how windy it was on Thursday, Friday, Saturday of this past week. Oh, I had more junk in my yard. I went out there a dozen damn times, and hey, it is what it is. I guess we get to it. But, I mean, this curbside recycling, I really do think, Jeff, most people would try to do the right thing. It has to be the least of this bottle bill, the least efficient, dirtiest, least sanitary way of trying to get some good thing accomplished that I could ever imagine.
You know, I'm not a big fan of government intervention and needlessly jacking up fees and taxes. But I have to say, this is one where I do agree. And I see it with my own eyes. Every, early on the morning of trash day, you see people coming through the neighborhood. There's one elderly woman with this Vietnamese, you know, those conical caps, conical hats that they wear, going through people's recycling bins, pulling out the things that still have the deposit on them.
Yeah.
And
You
see a lot less of them on the side of the road for exactly that reason. People with the motivation to collect them and make the money are people who are responding to an incentive that was created. So it definitely does some good.
We're going to mark this day down that on Monday, March 24, 2008, Jeff Jacoby, Tom Finneran, and Steve Bailey were all in agreement, at least on one particular item.
But now let me redeem my reputation and tell you that on the topic you were just talking about in the last hour, this is one where I really do break from the conventional wisdom. I think that the more that government does, the Commonwealth College, you know, that's fine. If we're going to have a UMass, might as well have a program within it that recognizes talent and hard work and good grades. But just, you know, taking one step back,
sure.
I really, really dissent from this notion that the way you make higher education affordable is to have more and more government programs to try to subsidize tuition or to reimburse tuition or to provide government-guaranteed student loans or Pell Grants. You know, I've written about it once or twice over the years, and the dynamic that seems to me to really be in place is that the more the government creates this array of subsidies to try to make higher education more affordable, the more unaffordable and the more expensive higher education becomes. And to me, it's perfectly clear why that happens. If the government were going to give out, if you could get grants to go buy a car, anybody who qualified, anybody who who's a citizen, whose parents weren't multimillionaires, could go and get, we'll call it the Finneran grant, and you would get $1,000 from the federal government that you could apply for the purchase of a car. What do you think would happen to the cost of cars in this?
It's going to go up by at least a G note.
Right, absolutely, and it seems to me that's exactly what's been happening for 60 years. We've been, ever since World War II, we've been pumping all this money into making college more affordable, and all we've accomplished is making it ever more unaffordable.
And I'll bet you're familiar with, Hillsdale College out there in Michigan,
Which that's is, right. Well, they refuse to accept a penny from the federal government.
You talk about acting really consistently on principle.
Yeah. And having the courage of their convictions.
I admire the curriculum. I admire the discipline. I admire just the transparency. And they say, look, we are not going to oblige the government in any of its edicts in any way, shape, or form. You come here for an education. This is what we focus on. This is how we build character, so on and so forth. I'm a huge admirer of Hillsdale.
Yeah,
big admirer of it.
I heard one of your callers late last hour was making the point, I don't think these were his exact words, but that essentially when you talk about state colleges and state universities, it's really a kind of welfare for the middle class and even the wealthy. You don't have to be poor to get this highly subsidized tuition to go to a state college or university in Massachusetts or any other state, as far as I know.
Yeah.
You can be the son of a millionaire. You can be from a very successful family with two high-earning parents. And, you'll get the same
which
is paid for, which is subsidized by hundreds of thousands of Massachusetts taxpayers, many of whom probably never had a chance to go to college.
Yeah, every single listener. And I'm glad you make the point, because I used to sometimes get into arguments with, different advocates on higher education about, gee, you have to do more, the price is too high. And I'd remind them, I said, the price might seem high to you, but 30% to 40% is being picked up by every taxpayer. That's really the extent
and
of the
think
subsidy.
That's actually, isn't that written into law that the tuition at the state colleges and state universities may not be more than one-third the cost of providing that education.
Yeah, that was actually a goal. I don't know that they ever did it. They did not do it while I was there, Jeff. I don't know that it's happened since I left the legislature, but that was certainly a goal of the advocates. I mean, can you imagine that the subsidy was going to become even more extensive? I recognize the pressures that the Jacoby family, the Finneran family, every family is under, but we've found different ways to do it. My daughters went to Holy Cross and, not a nickel of financial aid. We just did it because we deemed it worth their while and our while, and so we did it.
And the more the government insists that it's going to provide and it's going to subsidize and it's going to make affordable, in this as in too many other things, it ends up making the very problem that it sets out to correct worse.
Yeah.
But you try to say that, you try to explain that to people, and all they can see is the tuition bill that they've got to pay this month. And they're willing to grab assistance from whatever direction it comes.
Anywhere it comes, and then the beast feeds on itself, no question. Hey, speaking of the beast, you had a great column yesterday, the headline of which in the Sunday Globe, and I think we've probably already posted it up. If not, we are. The other David Mamet. Now, David Mamet, obviously very, very well-known playwright, and I guess has been a habitual denizen of the left, the intellectual and political left, and he's kind of come clean on this,
right,
and say less and less and less is he comfortable over there. You wrote about it yesterday. Jonah Goldberg from National Review writes about it today. Great minds think alike. Tell us what's going on over
there. Irving Kristol many years ago had this famous line about how a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. And, I alluded to that line in this column. David Mamet, the famous, one of the best known playwrights in working today in the theater, was mugged by reality. He was well known, as you say. He's from this area. He lives in New England. I think his office is in Cambridge.
Yes, I do. I believe so. Yeah.
He's had his plays produced as world premieres. At least one world premiere of his, I remember I mentioned attending 16 years ago at the Hasty Pudding Theater in Cambridge when his play Oleana was first produced. So he's written American Buffalo and Glengarry Glen Ross, many of which have been made into movies that listeners will remember even if they didn't see the play on stage. So he writes this essay in the Village Voice a couple of weeks ago. The headline was something like, Why I Am No Longer a Brain-Dead Liberal. And he opens with this great quote from John Maynard Keynes, the British economist from the 40s, who said, when the facts change, John Maynard Keynes was being criticized by someone who said he was being inconsistent. And Keynes said, when the facts change, I change my opinion. What do you do, sir? And David Mamet goes on to write about how for a long time he just took as granted the liberal ideology and opinions and assumptions that he basically took in with his mother's milk, but that the more he's looked at politics and thought about it and read about it, right now he's got a play on Broadway called November, and it deals with the president in the Oval Office who's a conservative, and he's got a speechwriter who's a liberal, and it's a comedy. But he says, I'm trying to make a serious point in this play as well, which is that there's this polemic going on between the conservative view and the liberal view of life. And he says, for years, his line is something like, I had it here somewhere, I took the liberal view for many decades, but I believe I have changed my mind. And what he says caused him to change his mind was realizing that the liberal worldview that he had taken for granted for so long simply didn't mesh with reality as he sees it all around him. And as he decided to write this political play, he began reading about politics. And he writes, "I began reading not only the economics of Thomas Sowell, our greatest contemporary philosopher, but Milton Friedman, Paul Johnson, and Shelby Steele, a host of conservative writers, and found that I agreed with them."
Yeah, and I love the point that you make in your article or column from yesterday, but that Mamet kind of noticed that the real world wasn't anywhere nearly as wretched as the liberal commentary makes it appear, and how well we actually live. You and I and every person listening, we have the most fabulous lives, really, in the recorded history of the planet, how well we live. And yet, again, according to the left wing of, politics, American politics, everything's going to hell in a handbasket.
Although there are exceptions on both sides, I think it's no surprise, no coincidence, that some of the most famous leftists in the world are so gloomy and negative and bitter. Think of Noam Chomsky. Have you ever heard him say a pleasant thing about anybody? It's always attacks and denunciations. Who is the most left-wing candidate who was running for president this year? I would say it was Denis Kucinich. Again, you see it. The way that he approaches the world, everything is terrible and awful, and there are problems all around, and we need more and bigger government to make them all better. Meanwhile, who are the most famous conservatives? The most famous conservative president of our era was Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan.
Famous
sure.
for his optimism.
Yep.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Bill Buckley died, William F. Buckley Jr., who also, again, famous for his good nature and cheerfulness. As I say, there are exceptions on both sides. But if you steep yourself in the liberal worldview, as I put it, misery abounds in the world. According to liberals, it's a world in which climate change devastates the environment and families struggle to make ends meet and hate crimes are terrorizing minorities and tobacco companies are poisoning children. Wherever you look, it's bad news.
Yeah.
Teachers don't make enough money and innocent people are in prison and nobody has health insurance and the good jobs are going overseas. This endless litany of gloom and doom and woe. And Mamet said, that just doesn't square with life as I know it. By and large, people do okay.
Yeah.
And we do okay in this country better than people do almost anywhere else in the world.
Jeff, you had a column, kind of a close cousin to this column, I'm guessing, at least a few, if not several months ago, in which you pointed out, I think maybe if not the headline, at least the theme was, the fight is on the right. That at least on the right-hand side of the American political spectrum, there was a robust discussion of ideas. And on the left side, it becomes very, very sterile. There's only one view, one size fits all. For example, on healthcare, it has to be a national health care system. Everybody has to be enrolled, so on and so forth. Our education has to be a certain way. That there is literally no dissent that seems to be allowed on the left. Where on the right, you have a good fist fight going on every couple of days.
Yeah, you look at the presidential race again, it's a good illustration. As you say, with health care, what really distinguishes Hillary Clinton from Barack Obama? Just details on the margins. You look at what they were arguing about in the Republican primary when that fight was going on. Immigration, pro or con. Should America be in a war overseas, pro and con? Which is more important, to cut spending or to cut taxes? The people who, like George W. Bush, who called himself the avatar of the compassionate conservatism, and the other conservatives who said that's the wrong approach, that's not the way we should be talking. Whatever the issue is, there seems to be a real heated debate about it on the right. And I think that although that can make it sometimes a little noisy and a little unpleasant, and you're not friends with everybody, I think it's healthy in the long run. Jonah Goldberg, you mentioned before, great writer for National Review and a syndicated columnist. I remember he and I were doing a debate on some radio program because he had written a column saying that if we knew now, and this actually sort of topical as well with the sad milestone of 4,000 deaths in Iraq that they just reached yesterday. He wrote a column saying, if we'd known then what we know now, I would have been against the war. We would never have gone in. And I saw that, and I wrote a column responding to him and saying, you could have said that in any war, in the Civil War, in World War II, in the Revolutionary War. There were dark hours when people might have been tempted to say, if we had known how bad it would be, we would never have done this. He and I are friends and mutual admirers, and I read his stuff, and I hope he reads mine. But that doesn't stop us from having some spirited intellectual feuding. I think it's good. Keeps you alive. Keeps you awake.
Oh, you know, it keeps the blood flowing. No question about it. We are talking to Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Let me remind people, by the way, the 20th Globe 100 magazine is going to be published again very, very shortly. It's a showcase of the state of Massachusetts' top businesses. You can pick up this issue on May 20th. And if you want to advertise in the Globe 100, visit globe100advertising.com. That's visit globe100advertising.com. Jeff, we were talking about the robust nature of the debate and the very, very different shades of nuance between Hillary and Barack. Let's talk a little presidential politics,
sure,
if we can. Let's talk McCain as the candidate himself, and then from Jeff Jacoby's point of view, ideal or likely VP candidates for Senator John McCain.
Oh, that's a good question. Typically presidential candidates want to have a running mate who will bring some kind of added strength to the ticket that the guy at the top of the ticket doesn't have. My colleague Joan Vernacki had a column the other day saying that she could see Mitt Romney being a running mate, and actually so could I. I think that there are definitely strengths that Romney would bring. They obviously had pretty spirited disagreements, especially on the immigration issue and others. It seems to be widely understood that the two men, that there's an antipathy between them, and whether that would keep Mitt off the ballot or not, I don't know. John F. Kennedy didn't think much of Lyndon Johnson, but he made him vice president.
But
in a way, the most interesting thing about Romney, the most valuable trait he might bring, is exactly the one that sank his candidacy for himself, which is that he seemed to be a little too flexible in what he stood for and what he espoused. But if you're a presidential candidate, you want a running mate who will be just as flexible as necessary to support your position, even if that means that he's tying himself a little bit in knots from what he used to say himself. You want a running mate who can go out and make the case for your candidacy, and if you get elected, for your administration, with all the vigor possible. There's a lot of talk about the governor of North Carolina, Mark Sanford, who a lot of conservatives admire and who seem to be a real, real up-and-comer and a go-getter. Actually, I've got, a real yen. I would love to see the new governor of Louisiana on a national ticket. His name is Bobby Jindal.
Jindal, sure.
He's the son of Indian immigrants from India, a brilliant young man. He's a Republican, and he got elected handily in Louisiana. I mean, you think about those words, Republican elected handily in Louisiana. It says something about, what Louisiana has experienced and how it's been prepared to go in a different direction than its tradition suggests. I think, adding somebody like that to the national Republican ticket would send an incredible message about inclusion and reaching out to every sector of the population. And as you know, I mean, I've written plenty of columns disagreeing with the conservative based on immigration. And I think to have the son of immigrants from India on a national Republican ticket would send a message that that Republicans are not the kind of isolationist, nativist, protectionist, seal the borders, pull the gangplank up types that to hear some of their spokesmen speak, you might think they were.
Yeah, what I call the Tancredo school.
The Buchanans, that type.
And it's curious how little Tancredo was able to progress, notwithstanding the supposed hue and cry out there for, very serious and aggressive.
In fact, he was the first candidate to drop out of the race.
No question about it. I liked Joan's column, Joan Vernacki, your colleague at the Globe. I liked her column pointing out as the economy and economic issues and concerns become more and more
salient.
Salient as far as the upcoming election, that this is going to be certainly in Romney's wheelhouse in terms of his ability to speak to that really in an impressive way. I think that's really what's part and parcel of his success here in Massachusetts when he won his own race for the governorship. It was based upon, I think, economic anxiety more than anything else.
I will say this. I think whoever McCain is prepared to offer the vice presidency to will grab it. For actuarial reasons. I mean, he would be the oldest president ever elected if he won, and without wanting to wish him ill, he should live to 120 and be healthy all the way through. But who wouldn't seize the opportunity to work to go be the vice president, the number two to somebody who will be in his 70s if he becomes president, when he gets elected.
Absolutely. Jeff, before we let you go, you've been great with your time. Give us your take on the Obama dynamics. I don't think last week was the best week he's had in his young and incredible life. Do you think he has put it behind him, or is this one of these unforgettable episodes that people might not be discussing openly today or tomorrow, but will never, ever forgive or forget the rhetoric to which he apparently willingly and happily...
Just judging from the reaction to the column that I wrote about it, I had a piece about how, I think the headline was something like, it's still a matter of right with a W and wrong. The response came flooding in from everywhere. I mean, far beyond anything that I had been anticipating. If that's the kind of response that, that you can get to a column about that subject, it tells me that this is an issue that really touched a nerve. I don't think he's put it behind him. It may not be on the front page anymore. But I think it hasn't been put behind him. It hasn't been forgotten. Hillary Clinton may not be able to make use of it to be able to exploit it to her advantage. But if Obama becomes the nominee, as it increasingly seems likely he will, I think that issue will resurface during the general election campaign, and we'll be hearing more about this candidate who sat for 20 years in a church where these kind of things were preached, and he called the guy who preached them his mentor and his spiritual father. And he donated tens of thousands of dollars to support, to support Jeremiah Wright's mission and his church. I think questions will be asked, and rightly so. I think that Obama was inconsistent in his answers and unconvincing in the excuses and the justifications that he ended up making. So no, I don't think it's behind him. I think we're going to see more of it.
You know, Hillary has been a huge beneficiary of, I think that, without having to do anything, and she'll stay miles away. I did bump into somebody over the weekend. I was going to visit my mom, who's in a rehab facility. I'm trying to spend a lot of time there. A wise old man came out, not so old, but a wise person came out and said, Tommy, the Obama miracle is over when they do the autopsy. When they do the autopsy, cause of death is going to be the one and only Reverend Wright. He put it that succinctly, and I said, I don't have to use his name. I said, you're kidding me. He said, oh, no. He said, this is real. This is going to last.
Did he think it was going to end his candidacy for the nomination or the general election?
No, he was speaking of the general election. He thinks he still is probably going to win this nomination, although I even think that is up for grabs. And I'm on record here multiple times as saying, certainly prior to this Reverend Wright episode, or episodes plural, that I thought he was going to secure the nomination. In the aftermath of the last two debates, where I thought he handled himself very well, very, very well, to her increasingly strident tone, I came back in here after those debates and said, you just saw the next president of the United States. I think he's going to win the nomination and win the election. I'm not so sure about that election now.
No, he ain't.
Yeah, no.
Have you announced which of the three you're supporting?
No, I have not. No, I have not.
Have you decided?
I'm saving that for a more propitious moment. Hey, we have been talking to Jeff Jacoby. He has been great with all of his time and his thoughts on a variety of topics. Definitely his column that was in yesterday's Globe, The Other David Mamet, will be posted up on our website here. Thanks to Jeff Jacoby, and thanks to the Boston Globe. Again, a reminder, coming soon, the 20th version of the Globe 100 magazine. The Globe 100 magazine is a showcase of Massachusetts' top businesses. Pick up this year's issue on May 20th. And if you're interested in advertising in the Globe 100, here's what to do. Visit globe100advertising.com. That address again, that email address, web address, globe100advertising.com. Special thanks to Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. We'll be back to you and your calls in a moment on Finneran's Forum, AM 680 WRKL.